This is the Business of Biotech. I'm Matt Piller, Chief Editor at Bioprocess Online, and your humble guide for today's discussion on Sleeping Beauty. Not the Disney movie, rather the moniker that the biopharm Xiopharm has given its platform to modify T-cells with DNA plasmids to express T-cell receptors, which target specific antigens in solid tumors, and chimeric antigen receptors to target CD19 and blood cancers. And we're going to get into that and the why behind the name shortly. But first, just a little bit about today's guest. Dr. Lawrence Cooper is CEO at Xiopharm, and he's been in that role since 2015. Previous to that, Dr. Cooper was a tenured professor at MD Anderson with joint appointments in the Division of Pediatrics and Department of Immunology, where he also served as section chief of cell therapy at the Children's Cancer Hospital. There, he helped lead scientific efforts to develop new treatment approaches which pair genetic engineering with immunotherapies. Dr. Cooper, welcome to the show. It's an honor to have you on.
Thank you so much. Delighted to be here.
So I want to start the conversation with a little bit more background on you and kind of what makes you tick and what's driven some of your career choices. And I guess I'd start that with, you know, it occurs to me that the bulk of your career prior to Xiopharm was spent in the hospital. What was the catalyst of making that move from the hospital to taking on the CEO role at Xiopharm?
Yeah, I know it was a big change and a new direction for me. I thought I would be die at my bench top with a stethoscope around my neck. Mm-hmm. I did not appreciate this new direction, and it really came about because of the licensing deal that Xiopharm did with MD Anderson around the technology that I had the opportunity to develop while I was professor at MD Anderson. And just to kind of give your audience some background here, back in the day, and in the time of COVID, it's hard to remember yesterday, but back in the day, there was actually a time when CAR T really wasn't, the buzz it has today. It was held as a belief system by a number of academics, Carl June, Steve Rosenberg, Malcolm Brenner, myself, Michelle Sadelain, the list goes on, but the list was small. And these individuals worked really hard behind the scenes, if you would, doing what academic medicine does really well, establishing the proof of concept that T cells could be genetically modified to target, in particular, blood cancers through what's called the chimeric antigen receptor or the CAR. That work was essentially done because I had patients who were relapsing with leukemias and lymphomas despite our best efforts. I led the bone marrow transplant program that was treating patients, children who had really very bad leukemias and lymphomas, basically refractory to all known therapy. And we would be doing biology, doing T-cell therapy on them in the guise of bone marrow transplantation. That idea worked. In fact, Don Thomas was given the Nobel Prize for that. But that idea had limitations. And the limitations were one in which not everybody got treated. Not everybody who was treated, got cured. And so we said, well, look, if T-cells are working in the context of bone marrow transplantation, could we get them to work better? Could we provide what Mother Nature essentially couldn't? Could we engineer an immune response? So all of that work was going on in the background while I was running the clinical service, and the technology worked. This is one of these, real success stories where my lab and other labs developed fundamental science showing how you could engineer T cells to go after blood cancers and did the initial proof of concept trials in these academic centers. Mm-hmm. That then essentially got the attention of Wall Street. That then resulted in these large licensing deals, not just at MD Anderson, but really across the country, really around the world, actually, at this point, that then spurred then this whole industry we now know as cell and gene therapy. And that then was the impetus for me to switch from the academic world to the corporate world.
Yeah.
That's the background.
It's a great story. And I think it certainly lends to the discussion we're going to have a bit later on about sort of the logistics and physical characteristics of the lab space, if you will, in which Zile Pharma is doing its work. It sounds like you're doing some of that, like, you know, close to the hospital setting early on prior to Zile Pharma. So that's some great background there. I want to ask, do you miss it? Do you miss, I mean, obviously you've got exciting things going on at Zile Pharma. So
no, absolutely, I miss that. Absolutely. I mean, how could you not miss it? Look, there's a moral imperative to treating kids with cancer. You know, it's a very noble, you know, pure profession. And I trained, you know, for decades to be able to basically take care of the nation's most medically fragile children and to be able to provide this treatment. But I just sort of, you know, lead on to perhaps the directionality of your comments here. You know, when you're a physician, you have the privilege of taking care of that patient in the room at that time. And that's a very special interaction, but it's frankly just not scalable. That's the reason that, you know, industry, Zile Pharma, is so important to me and I think to many others, because it offers that opportunity to take ideas and really take them beyond the door of that hospital bed out into the broader community.
So, And I'm curious about also that your focus on pediatric oncology. Does that continue to drive the mission at Zile Pharma? I mean, I'm sure it's broader than that, but is it still kind of a central tenet of Dr. Cooper?
Yeah, that's very much so. You know, I have always had, you know, an ability to talk to kids. You know, I just sort of think back to the Thanksgiving table, and I don't know if it's the same as in your house. There's sort of be the grown-up table. Mm-hmm. And they'd be the kids' table kind of thing. Sure, and I would find myself, even as sort of a teenager, at the kids' table.
Yeah.
You know, and so it just sort of this, you know, this empathy, really, this ability to communicate with kids around complicated ideas so that they could, you know, feel comfortable, at least, you know, in the broad sense about what was going on. That's part of, you know, who I am. And it's a, you know, I don't want to be put too much sort of, you know, emphasis on it, but it is a bit of a calling. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to want this. You have to advocate for kids. And so the same thing happens at Zile Pharma. And I'm really lucky in the corporate culture that we've built at Zile Pharma, both with management and the board, in that they support that advocacy for kids. And it's not easy. It's not easy, you know. Our, you know, we have to deliver value to the shareholders, but we've been able to navigate essentially how we can do both have essentially opportunities for kids as well as deliver value. And here I'm talking about our program for this horrible tumor, you know, called DIPG, which is a brainstem cancer of kids. Mm-hmm. It's just unforgiving and unrelenting in its ability to take kids' lives. And we have now a program that we have launched. We treated our first child on that program, which really is, you know, I think stands as a highlight about how we can both deliver new therapies for kids as well as deliver value for the investor.
Yeah. All right. Great. So let's talk a bit about the platform then. And I want to, I'm gonna read some corporate material. Just a quick sentence that sort of encapsulates, you know, from Zile Pharma, what your platform entails, and then I'm gonna ask you some questions about it. So your company is implementing, and this is the quote, a non-viral cell therapy platform that has the potential to produce T cell therapies that are scalable to meet the needs and numbers of patients at a fraction of the cost and time of currently approved therapies. So I emphasized a few words there that I'd like to unpack. But before we get into the unpacking, I just want to get right to the heart of the matter here, the sleeping beauty moniker.
Right.
What's the story behind that name? Where did that come from?
Yeah, so it doesn't come from me. It comes from a very fine scientist by the name of Perry Hackett at the University of Minnesota. And, you know, for your audience, you know, you should certainly Google Perry Hackett. He's a remarkable intellect. So the Sleeping Beauty originates in his lab because he was working at the time for the fish and wildlife industry.
Hmm.
And so this is a bit of a tangent, but it's a fun story. So he had the idea when he was working with them about how he could repopulate some of the trout that had been fished out in the lakes of Minnesota. So, you know, game fishermen had come in and depleted some of the population, and the state said, look, let's get the fish stocks back up. And so Perry, in his, you know, just really transcendent ability to solve problems, said, look, let's start engineering fish to grow bigger. And this is way back before anybody really thought about these types of genetic engineering solutions, but he didn't have a great way to genetically modify the fish genome. But he was astute enough to recognize that if he sequenced and looked inside of the fish DNA, there were elements, vestigial elements of viruses that had long ago in evolutionary time actually infected fish.
Okay.
And these elements essentially were called, as we now know them, as transposons. And they could essentially be identified through special genetic signatures. And he then was astute enough to say, okay, if that ancient virus had infected that fish and integrated into the fish genome, what if, dot, 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 what if we took the elements back out of the fish genome and remade it, remade, if you would, the elements of that ancient virus. Mm-hmm. And so he reawakened it. He reawakened it, and that's why it became Sleeping Beauty.
Yeah.
So actually that story continues because Perry then could put these elements into DNA. He actually didn't have to make the full virus anymore. He was, again, clever enough to think about this could just be a simple DNA plasmid, a non-viral solution. And he was successful in actually genetically modifying those trout. And your audience may be able to still ping the reports, but to my knowledge, these trout still exist. They were never released because the state got nervous.
Sure.
Again, about, you know, super trout or something.
Right.
But they are penned in some, you know, holding tank all these many, many years later. I think just getting fatter and fatter on the state taxpayers' expense.
Wow. Wow, that's an incredible story.
It's a good story.
Yeah. So now that we've got the Sleeping Beauty understanding, the backstory on that, let's start unpacking some of those words in the platform language. And I want to start with the needs and numbers of patients point. How would you sort of characterize the needs and numbers, and why is that an important part of that statement?
That's right. And let's actually take us back now to when I was head of bone marrow transplantation on the pediatric service. So we were developing therapies at the time, CAR T therapies, but recognized that it would be difficult to essentially take what was scarce grant dollars, you know, limited ability to access GMP facilities, and be able to treat the numbers of patients in an academic setting, right?
Mm-hmm.
So even at that time, you know, a decade or so ago, we were thinking hard about how you could scale and how you could scale these genetically modified T cells to meet the patient's numbers and do it in a way you didn't break the bank. You know, for instance, I had patients on my transplant service, and the number one risk for financial bankruptcy was their kid getting sick, right? Mm. So just as a physician, you knew immediately that if we started developing CAR T and TCRT that was so expensive, it would just compound the problems that these patients were going through. So it's one thing to invent life-saving therapies, but you got to do it in the context of what people can afford, what they can access.
Sure.
So we hit upon, with Perry as a collaborator, the idea that the Sleeping Beauty system, this non-viral approach, would sidestep a lot of the current issues that folks were facing when they were using viral-based manufacture, when they were using, you know, what's called retroviruses or lentiviruses. Mm-hmm. And the reason there is that DNA is cheap and easy to make. In fact, to be honest, your high school kids make DNA in one form or another as part of their biology course now.
Mm-hmm.
So that ability to make DNA is at its root so simple that it can be scaled to achieve, really the needs of the patients and at the same time not break the bank. And we can contrast that with the way investigators and industry are using viruses. And just to give your audience, perhaps in the sort of the modern parlance, a sense of how you make a virus. So it requires an incubation period. And you kind of know that from COVID. You know, we've seen so much in the news, right, about what an incubation period is and are you infectious and so forth and so on. Well, the reason is because the virus is busy generating itself in tissue culture or in the body. Both of those are known as incubation periods. When you are propagating viruses in tissue culture, that takes time and money to do so. A DNA plasmid cuts all of that out. Basically, you're just taking the genetic elements, and that's all you need. You don't need to do any incubation or any propagation in tissue culture. Right. So that really allows for these economies of scale that get at the numbers that we want to treat. You know, I mean, again, put a pin in it, 1.5 million Americans every year have an invasive cancer, have a solid tumor. And how are we going to get to that point if we're stuck using viruses?
The business of biotech is brought to you in partnership with Cytiva. Together, we're committed to helping the leaders of new and emerging biopharma companies navigate the financial, organizational, human resources, and regulatory waters you'll encounter on your way from discovery to the clinic and beyond. Check out a host of useful resources for biotech leaders at Cytiva's Emerging Biotech Accelerator at CytivaLifeSciences.com/emerging biotech. That's CYTIVA LifeSciences.com/emerging biotech.
Let's drill into the speed part a little bit more. What is the production process look like in practice? What's happening, in other words?
Yeah, to make a genetically modified T cell.
Yeah, what's happening to the patient's T cells in the lab?
Yeah. So there are, in general, three major steps. And this is really independent of Xiapharm. This is just to the field. The first is the genetic modification of the T cells. So in other words, putting your gene in. Now, we talked about Sleeping Beauty here, but it could be a virus. The second is the growth of those cells so that they achieve the expression of the introduced receptor, whether it's a CAR or a TCR. And the third is the release criteria. In other words, the checkboxes that the regulators look at to make sure that the product is authentic, is sterile, expresses the gene, does what you say it's going to do. Each one of those three things essentially has to be managed to make a clinical grade product. And maybe with your permission, I can now go through how Xiapharm thinks of each of these three steps for our CAR T program.
Sure.
So the first is the genetic modification. And here, Sleeping Beauty has an advantage over a virus because it has an additional property that I can now tell your readers. And that is that because of the way the Sleeping Beauty gets inside the nucleus, it can cross over the nuclear membrane without any other special tricks of the trade. So if we think about a cell as two bags, one bag is the cell membrane and the inside bag is the nucleus. Any genetic material has to get across the outside, the cell membrane, and then across the second membrane, the nuclear laminin, the nuclear membrane. Sleeping Beauty, when we electroporate, we apply an electric field across the cell. Those DNA plasmids can do that 1-2 step. Get into the nucleus, and then because it's a transposon, because it's this ancient, essentially, virus, it has all of the genetic material baked within it that it can then sew itself like a sewing machine into the nucleus, into the genome of the T cell. Mm-hmm. A virus, different. So a retrovirus and a lentivirus can get across the first membrane, but it can't get across the second membrane, can't get across the nucleus, and so it can't actually infect the cell or transduce the cell unless the cell divides. Because when your cell divides, of course, the nuclear membrane breaks down. One cell makes 2, 4, 8, and so forth. Right. And every time the nuclear membrane breaks down, so the little virus then goes, oh, the nuclear laminin's gone away. I can now get inside, and now I can integrate, right? So the big step change that we made in the CAR-T is that we recognized that we didn't have to grow cells. We didn't have to replicate or propagate cells. We could directly insert the transgene across the nuclear membrane and get expression of the CAR. So that then allowed us to say, what about the second step? Do we need to propagate the cells at all? Because if you don't need to propagate them to get the gene in, maybe we never have to propagate them to put them into the body. And we solve for that by putting in an extra gene called membrane-bound IL-15. It's a stimulatory molecule for T cells. It's a go, go, go signal for T cells. By therefore eliminating the ability to propagate the cells, because now we have IL-15 driving the cells, we could then approach the third step, the release criteria. And we've worked with the regulators to have the release criteria essentially the same day we infuse the cells. That's a major step forward, because many other companies essentially have to do multi-day release testing. So now we can do these three steps in 2 days. We electroporate the first day, and we release the cells and infuse them on the second day. Mm-hmm. That is just a huge step forward as we think about CAR-T, because again, it gets back to this idea we had when we were back in academia of how do you scale? You can scale if you get the manufacturing down to next day infusion. And how do you get the cost down? Well, you can get the cost down by getting rid of the virus and getting rid of really the need to propagate cells at all.
Right. Can you share any, I guess, anything close to a quantifiable thought around that speed and cost savings? I mean, I've heard, you know, when I've read about Xiopharm and heard, you know, the premise that perhaps your cancer could be treated within a day of its diagnosis. So, you know, we hear that kind of speed.
Yeah.
Can you quantify the potential cost savings?
Sure.
As well, or is that difficult to do?
Look, yeah, absolutely. These are big visions, you know, and big thoughts. They take, you know, time to come into focus. And quite frankly, each step of the way, you have to pressure test it, right? If we make too big a leap, it's not authentic, and, you know, we trip ourselves, right? So along the way now, we have discrete pieces of data that just go to what you're saying, that we could treat your cancer the next day, right? Mm-hmm. But we have to walk before we can run. So what are the steps that we're putting into place now? The first is the proof of principle that this next day infusion works. And where better else to do it than in the CD19 CAR space? We know up and down now how to treat patients with CD19-directed T cells. You know, there are two commercial products. There are, you know, probably dozens, if not more, companies working in this space. And so there's everything that we need to know wrapped around that. And we can answer the question, does the next day infusion work? And check that box. And we will know really in these coming months about that. We have an IND that's open at MD Anderson. We have a whole regulatory process in Greater China that's actually coming into focus. So patients will go on the study and we will learn. If that works and that shows that these cells can be made rapidly, then it can then marry to the next step, if you would. And that is the genetic modifications of T cells to express T cell receptors as opposed to chimeric antigen receptors. And T cell receptors have the unique ability to sniff out danger that's occurring inside the cancer cell. Mm-hmm. CARs are restricted in their ability to basically handshake with, in other words, look at the cell membrane and only look at what's on the cell membrane of cancer cells. T cells can peer inside, so you can look at many, many more antigens with T cell receptor modified cells. So we're gearing up then to essentially now answer the next question, and that is, do TCR modified cells, not made with the 2-day manufacturing, but just the sort of the 1-2-3-step process, if you would. Electroporate, grow, release, okay? We're gearing up to get that to work. We have an IND at the NCI with Steve Rosenberg. We have a whole build-out process at MD Anderson that's ongoing, literally, as I talk today, about a corporate approach with MD Anderson to learn from Steve Rosenberg to get it onto onto the company line. That then will be the second, if you would, step. You know, then we have the rapid manufacturing with the CAR T, we have the TCRs working, and then we go to just what you're saying. If that all lines up, then we can then dial in the manufacturing, really for almost immediate production of the T cells for patients who have a variety of cancers. And that's a dream that I've had for over a decade now. You know, I started writing about this when I was at MD Anderson. And, you know, to see it now come into focus and to hit that scale, right? Not just for the 1s and 2 patients, but potentially as a worldwide ability to change the way we think about treating cancer is just a privilege. I mean, you know, I'm just a lucky guy.
In a commercial, let's say, you know, quote unquote, commercial environment, you've progressed with the therapy. You're able to scale it for commercial use. What does that look like? I mean, is it still sort of a hospital, you know, lab operation, or do you produce at scale in a large production facility?
Yeah, it could go a couple of different ways. Okay, so the first, you know, again, let me just take you back to being a physician. This is really where, you know, I am driven by. Mm-hmm. And so when, you know, if you just join with me in your mind for a second and you're at the kid's bedside and you recognize the kid's anemic because of chemotherapy undergoing bone marrow transplantation, you call down to the blood bank to get red blood cells, right? That's a standard practice. Kid is thrombocytopenic, has low platelets. You call down to get platelets, right, from the blood bank. But when you recognize the kid is lymphopenic, as all the kids are on a bone marrow transplant service, as many, many patients are who get chemotherapy, there's nobody to call. There's no blood bank to call, right? They don't have a T cell production facility in blood banks. Yeah. So as part of my thinking here, and again, you know, the way we begin to, you know, scope out ZyoPharm to be the disruptor and really the winner in the field, is what would it take then to make blood banks into sites of T cell production? This is a very powerful and scalable vision, because blood bankers are really good. They actually do GMP. We never think about them doing good manufacturing practice, but they do. They have chain of custody and they have sterility. So if we can put in place technology like what I talked about, next day infusion of T cells, the automated, if you would, processing of T cells, blood bankers could participate in that production. In other words, they would become a pharmacy. They would become an ability to generate product on site, really synchronous with the patient's need.
Yeah.
That's a big vision. It's a big vision, but you got to have a big vision to really be able to put in place disruptive, life-changing abilities. You know, we're talking again, you know, 1.5 million Americans every year have solid tumors, the majority of which will die, despite the billions that are being poured into treatment. So for those patients, we have to have what Americans do really well, and that's innovate. And that is this idea that we can have a highly distributed way to essentially produce T cells. But again, you can't go there today. You have to be able to bake this in science and in something that people could really get their hands around. Sure. So that's the reason why it's kind of a two-part answer. So to get to that promised land of highly distributed manufacturing, there's going to be some degree of sort of centralized or local regional manufacturing to make sure that the pieces work. Because again, you know, we don't want to waste people's time, whether it's patients or investors. We're going after the big prize, but we want to do it in a way that's organized and stepwise.
Mm-hmm. But you think long term, you believe the decentralized approach, the local approach is a better place to be. The place
absolutely,
we want to get.
Absolutely. Yeah. And think about it from the point of view of you now run a hospital, right? You're writing the checks. Your patients are coming into the hospital. Who are you writing the check to right now, right? You're writing them to some commercial operator which delivers a bag of cells. Mm-hmm. And that bag of cells that is infused. So you, the hospital, are kind of a pass-through at the moment, right? Right. You know, yes, you have to manage the complications. But if you look at the economics of CAR T, it's pretty unfavorable for the hospital administrator set, that ecosystem. Sure. If you now give those hospital administrators the ability to make the product themselves on site, because they are essentially, they would buy, presumably from Ziopharm plasmid, the know-how to make the TCR on the CAR T, then you are sharing in that economics, right? It's a win-win for both sides, and that will move the whole field to this highly distributed manufacturing because both sides want it. It's not me pushing the idea of distributed manufacturing. Sure. The administrators will want it.
Yeah, from an infrastructure standpoint, and you're the perfect guy to ask because you've got a lot of time in the hospital and on the biopharma side. From an infrastructure and personnel, human resources standpoint, how close are hospitals to being equipped to be able to do that kind of work, that distributed production work?
Yeah, some of them already do it. Mm-hmm. If you look at these sort of quaternary referral centers, MD Anderson, Memorial Sloan Kettering, Penn, these types of centers, they already have their GMP nested into their academic practice. And in fact, they're putting a lot of their treasure into building out even more of these, so-called GMP facilities. So it is becoming accepted as part of the routine for many academic centers in this sort of these Uber centers to do this. But reality is many, many patients are treated outside of the academic center, right? Most patients with cancer want to be treated in their local environment by their local oncologists in their local hospitals. That's where essentially the mind share and the economics will be won or lost. And it'll either be the CAR-T and TCR-T are in essentially the community hospitals, or it'll get moved into the boutique, into where bone marrow transplant is, the highly specialized, nuanced therapy that are delivered at these sort of, quaternary academic centers. I'm in the business of making sure that the most patients can get the best therapy for all of these cancers and get it out into the community. And that's why you have to simplify the process. You can't have long-term manufacturing in complicated bioreactors if you're going to move this to the community setting. And that's why these technologies like next day infusions become so interesting, I think, for patients and providers.
Mm-hmm. It seems like there's a lot of conversation. We may be getting way off topic here, but so excuse me. But there's been a lot of conversation around the supply chain,
yep,
and availability in the wake of COVID-19. Right, disruption to the global supply chain, the impact on bioprocessing equipment, even not just raw materials. It sounds to me, and correct me if I'm wrong here, it sounds to me like this approach is a bit more insulated from those potential global disruptions down the road as well.
I think you stated well. If you can align the infusion center with the production center, less things will go wrong. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that vision is part of the reason why, Ziopharm works so hard on understanding, this very rapid manufacturing, understanding how you can get T cells to behave, not just with CARs, but TCRs, and then to put it all together so that you can essentially limit the uncertainties around the supply chain. I mean, it's an excellent point.
Yeah. Well, we're running short on time, Dr. Cooper, so I want to give you an opportunity to share some concluding thoughts with us. But first, I just want to acknowledge what an honor it's been to speak with you, and how there's a lot to absorb here. Your vision is big. It's a very big vision. And I hope that I'm grasping it effectively. But I wish you luck. I mean, I think it's an amazing thing that you're working on. And I wish you luck in achieving that vision. What would you share sort of as a concluding thought for our listeners?
Yeah, and I appreciate it. You know, again, it's a privilege to be able to talk with you and your audience. Look, Xiophon wants to treat patients big and small. Mm-hmm. And we're not a me-too company. We have ideas that are unique, that are born from wisdom of being in that room with that cancer patient. But I know, and my colleagues know, what's needed now to change the game. You know, going after solid tumors, not just liquid tumors. What do you need to go after solid tumors? It's TCRs. What do you need to be able to go after some of the worst of worst solid tumors, like brain cancers? We talked about pediatric cancers, but also adult brain cancers. Well, you need powerful cytokines, we mentioned one, interleukin-15, but you need others like interleukin-12. And then how do you put together a company that has multiple shots on goal that can essentially walk towards the vision, not be some, you know, aspirational dream factory, but be laid out solidly, one step in front of the other, making progress, and to be able to deliver on what is essentially just game-changing technology so that you, our kids, don't have to go through the same types of therapies that we have to go through today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I apologize. You mentioned shots on goal, and I didn't give you an opportunity to kind of give us an update on your pipeline. You've got 3 or 4 candidates at this point that are...
Yeah, we have them all under INDs. We have technologies using a cytokine called interleukin-12, a very powerful cytokine that we have now controlled with a switch. We can basically dose patients so that we can turn on and off their cytokine levels or IL-12 levels. Those trials are enrolling, and we'll have data reported actually this year on that data set. And then we have our CAR-T program, both in the United States as well as in Greater China. And we have our TCR program at Bethesda with Steve Rosenberg at the NCI, and then soon to be launched out at MD Anderson in Houston. All of these programs essentially have data to report out, you know, over the coming months, and which I think will be very interesting for both our own learning as well as for the investor.
All right. Well, we'll be staying tuned and paying attention and keeping an eye out for that data. In the meantime, Dr. Cooper, keep up the great work, the inspiring work, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for the attention. Yeah, appreciate it.
That's Dr. Lawrence Cooper. I'm Matt Piller, and this is The Business of Biotech. We are produced by Bioprocess Online in partnership with Cytiva, which offers a host of amazing resources for new and emerging biotechs, including every episode of The Business of Biotech podcast at CytivaLifeSciences.com/emerging biotech. That's worth your time to check out. It's also worth your time to subscribe to our newsletter at BioprocessOnline.com. Go do that now. And in the meantime, thanks for listening.